Hello. I think we'll begin. So if people are milling about in the outside lobby there, perhaps they want to come in and join us. My name is Leo Panitch. I'm professor of political science at York University, and I'm honored to be moderating this very important panel at a troubling and historic moment for our country. We have on this panel Professor Emeritus Ursula Franklin. Emeritus means retired, but of course we know she's not really. Least of all retired from being what I often think of as the conscience of Canada. We have Eileen Carroll. Eileen is the MP for Barrie Simcoe and Bradford, Parliamentary Secretary for the Honourable John Manley, Minister of Foreign Affairs. And we have my colleague at York, Michael Mandel, professor of law at Osgoode Hall Law School, a leading figure in Lawyers Against the War. I'm very pleased to have them all here. The order we'll proceed in will be that Michael Mandel will speak first, Eileen Carroll will go second, and Ursula Franklin will bat cleanup. The speakers will speak for something like 10, perhaps a few more minutes. Then I'll allow for some interchange between them, and then we'll open the floor to some discussion. We're hoping to wrap up this session at about 5, so we have just over an hour. Michael.
Thanks, Leo. Great pleasure to be here, honored to be here, actually. I'm a lawyer, and I hope you'll try, please, not to hold that against me. Deep down, as they say, we're really good guys. I'm with a group called Lawyers Against the War, and this is lawyers, professors, law students from across Canada, 7 other countries, actually. And I have a sheet, an info sheet for anybody, any lawyers or closet lawyers that are interested in this this group. And Noam Chomsky's just joined our group. I know he's not a lawyer, but we accepted him anyway. We may have to change the name of the group, though. Anyway, as a lawyer, it's natural that I look at things from a legal point of view, and from the legal point of view, this war is illegal. Of course, it's also immoral, and it won't prevent terrorism, but it's very important that it's illegal. The war is illegal because it's a flagrant violation of the express words of the Charter of the United Nations. In fact, it's not only illegal, it's criminal. It's what the Nuremberg Tribunal called the supreme crime, crime against peace. Charter of the United Nations is the most authoritative document in international law. It seeks to ban war as a scourge. Its very first words are, "We, the people of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war." War is permitted only when it's absolutely and demonstrably necessary. And the Charter doesn't leave that to individual states, no matter how powerful they are. Necessity is entirely a matter for the Security Council, with only one exception, the very, very narrow and limited right of self-defense. Now, the Security Council passed 2 resolutions on terrorism between September 11th and America's attack on Afghanistan on October 7th. Of course, the editorial writers in Canada, the United States, they've tried to paste sentences together to make it seem like these resolutions authorize this attack, but that's just a lie. And you can verify it for yourself by reading the resolutions at the UN website. No honest reading of these resolutions could possibly conclude they authorize the use of military force. They condemn the attacks of September 11th. They take a whole host of measures to suppress terrorism, legal, financial, administrative, judicial, etc. But not once does either of these resolutions mention military force. They don't even mention Afghanistan by name. Without authorization by the Security Council, the only legally admissible use of military force is the inherent right of self-defense preserved by Article 51 of the Charter of the... I'm not going to give you a law lecture, just going to quickly establish the illegality of this war, and then we can move on to not the legal issues, the real issues. But this Charter preserves by Article 51 the inherent right of self-defense until the Security Council has taken measures necessary to maintain international peace and security. And a lot's been made of the fact that this right is mentioned in one of the paragraphs of the preamble of both resolutions. There's buried among many other things, you find this little sentence, recognizing the inherent right of individual or collective self-defense in accordance with the Charter. And then it goes on to take all the other measures. Now, anyone with a passing familiarity with the English language I'll go further. Even George W. Bush can see that this doesn't even come close to authorizing the U.S. attack on Afghanistan, not only because neither country is even mentioned, but also, more importantly, because this statement is clearly just a non-committal recognition of a legal right that exists even without the recognition of it. For all the passage says, it could be Afghanistan that has the right to attack the United States. In other words, it all depends on whether what's going on fits within the right of self-defense, something on which the resolution takes no position. But the attack on Afghanistan doesn't fit the right of self-defense. The attack on Afghanistan is as little an exercise in the right of self-defense as the attack on the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon. There are at least four different reasons for this. In the first place, the right of unilateral self-defense is not authorized by the Security Council. It's a temporary right. There's simply no getting around the word until in Article 51. It's limited to the right to repel an attack that's actually taking place or to dislodge an illegal occupier. It doesn't include the right to retaliate once an attack is stopped. It doesn't include the right to overthrow a government that one holds in some way responsible for the attack and install another one. And it doesn't include the right to take long-term preventive measures of a military nature. It doesn't include the right to arrest people for who are accused of crimes. When Israel kidnapped Eichmann, Israel admitted it had broken international law. And he was a Nazi with the blood of millions on his hands. And no one was injured when he was kidnapped. A state's allowed to exercise self-help when there's no time for the Security Council to intervene, and until it can intervene. The Security Council has been in permanent session since September 11th. It defies the imagination how one, a permanent member of the Security Council, one who's voted for all the measures that have been taken, could justify a long, open-ended war against terrorism on the ground that the Security Council hasn't had time to intervene. This rule is fundamental to the whole UN system. If it were otherwise, a superpower like the United States would have a legal blank check to intervene wherever it likes for as long as it likes, even if there had been no attack whatever, because this is not a defense against the attack on September 11th. This is a defense against future attacks. In fact, that's what President Bush wrote himself on September 20th, 2001, a blank check, when he declared that there are thousands of these terrorists in more than 60 countries. Every nation, every region now has a decision to make. Either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. From this day forward, any nation that continues to harbor or support terrorism will be regarded by the United States as a hostile regime. If this were regarded as a valid exercise of the right of self-defense under Section 51, the job of the Security Council to take primary and ultimate responsibility for the use of military force, that is to judge its necessity, to use it only when absolutely necessary, these are the words of the Charter of the United Nations, and to seek every possible peaceful solution first, to publicly set the objectives, impose limits and supervise the limits, this job of the Security Council would be over. It would be the end of the United Nations Charter. That's probably what the United States wanted when it voted for this resolution. It wanted the Security Council out of the way so it could do its dirty work without anybody looking over its shoulder like some Latin American torturer it had trained. Maybe it wanted more than this, and this was all that that Russia or China would give it. But it doesn't matter because the Security Council has no power to shirk its responsibility this way or any other. It's a disgrace that the members of the Security Council have acted in this way, but it doesn't make it any more legal. They have the responsibility to seek peace or authorize war where absolutely necessary. They can't just wash their hands like Pontius Pilate. And the same goes for Kofi Annan. If anyone should ever give back a Nobel Peace Prize, it's this guy who sat on his behind like the Americans' hand-picked Secretary General that he is. You know that Boutros Ghali was vetoed by the Americans, and Kofi Annan was installed in his place. Kofi Annan, his previous job was as NATO's liaison to the Secretary General. And he was put there to keep his mouth shut when they want him to, and that's what he's been doing. Second thing about self-defense, my next-door neighbor pointed out, the right of self-defense in domestic law doesn't allow you to go out and shoot the first person you see. The law of self-defense under international law is the same, a fundamental legal condition for the invocation of the right of self-defense is the existence of an armed attack by the state against whom the right of self-defense is claimed. Now, the U.S. has alleged that the attack originated in Afghanistan with bin Laden and the al-Qaeda network, but although the evidence, you know, that was revealed by Tony Blair before the bombing and accepted by Pakistan, along with billions of dollars of loan forgiveness and the end of U.S. sanctions, that evidence wouldn't stand up in traffic court. But nowhere is it even alleged that the government of Afghanistan participated in the planning or execution of this attack, only that it harbored terrorists by allowing them to operate on their territory. Precisely the same claim was made by the United States in the World Court in 1986 to defend its bombing of Nicaragua. And it was laughed out of court. Reading that case is like deja vu. In the Nicaragua case, the World Court also set out a third condition for self-defense. And it said that the United States hadn't demonstrated the necessity of self-defense, because self-defense in international law and domestic law alike is a branch of the law of necessity. It's only justified when all other possible measures are demonstrably unavailable. In the case of Afghanistan, none of the many realistic non-military alternatives, such as UN mediation or international judicial proceedings, were even explored. Negotiations were offered by the Taliban, were rejected out of hand by the United States, which only issued a series of ultimatums to give it the time to put its armada in place. And of course, very important for necessity, this attack won't prevent terrorism, even on the Americans' narrow definition. Even if the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden and Mullah Omar disappear from the face of the earth, because you have to be a fool or a Texan to believe that they're the causes and not just the symptoms. And you have to be a fool or a liar not to recognize that high on the list of the causes are the many deep and festering wounds the U.S. has inflicted on the Arab and Muslim world. Bush and the CNN zombies would have us believe that they were attacked because they're a beacon of freedom. Some beacon of freedom. Did you know the United States has a higher proportion of its population behind bars than any country in the world? 2 million adults on any given day. Maybe if they'd attacked Sweden, you could say they were attacking a beacon of freedom, but not the United States. They had lots of reasons to attack the United States besides freedom, like American support for corrupt and repressive Arab governments, for example, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, where American military aid is the only thing that keeps them in power, or the American guarantee of Israel's brutal, indeed terrorist, and completely illegal occupation of the West Bank and Gaza wouldn't have lasted 34 weeks, let alone 34 years, without the American financing and supply of the most sophisticated weapons in its armory. 10 years illegally bombing Iraq, accompanied by a sanctioned regime that is reputably estimated to have killed hundreds of thousands of Iraqi children. For 40 or 50 years now, the United States has been spearheading a Western war against the Middle East over oil, a war of the rich against the poor. American musician Quincy Jones recently put it in an interview in the Globe and Mail like a line from a rap song. That's why this fucking war is going on. That's why, because the gap between rich and poor is too wide. And that's essentially the message, if in more genteel language, of 100 Nobel Peace Prize winners on Friday, who declared that the most profound danger to world peace in the coming years will stem from the legitimate demands of the world's dispossessed for the wider degree of social justice that alone gives hope of peace. That's 100 Nobel Prize winners. In my non-Nobel Prize winning estimation, they have a good point. By the way, I noticed that Kofi Annan did not sign that declaration. The Americans and the Israelis want us to believe that all the pain and humiliation they inflict on the Arab world has nothing to do with the suicide bombers. It reminds you of the tobacco companies used to swear that cigarettes had nothing to do with cancer. But when they asked the Americans after September 11th if they were willing to bomb Afghanistan, even if thousands of civilians should die, 58% said yes. And what do you think the number would have been before September 11th? Or is it the Americans, only the Americans, who have reasons for violence? Another reason, fourth reason why this isn't self-defense, is that the right of self-defense is bound by the rules of proportionality. But the United States is claiming a completely unlimited right of retaliation. In fact, far from the prevention of terrorism, this attack is terrorist in itself. What else can you say about an attack that is carried out to teach America's enemies, terrorists or not, that, in George Bush's words, they will share Afghanistan's fate? What do you call an attack that shows zero mercy and zero respect for the laws of war, pounding away at a primitive army, at cities and caves, using the most hideously efficient technology of death ever invented, bunker busters, daisy cutters, heat-seeking missiles, night vision to bury soldiers alive in their sleep, anti-human cluster bombs that have already killed and maimed civilians and continue to kill and maim civilians for years after this bombing has stopped, the inevitable errant bombs that kill 150 villagers at one throw, the bloody vengeance wreaked by the Northern Alliance after the Americans made their conquest a cakewalk, civilians dead at the hands of panicked Taliban, and last week's mind-boggling prison massacre. An American advisor with a cell phone calls down airstrikes in a prison yard until every last resistor is dead. This isn't self-defense. This is slaughter, kind of butchery you see in an abattoir. It's meant to kill, but above all, it's meant to terrorize. So the non-committal recognition of the right of self-defense in the preamble of the Security Council resolutions is irrelevant because this isn't self-defense. Security Council might as well have affirmed the right to fly a kite for all that has to do with what's going on in Afghanistan. Does legality matter in a case like this? I can leave at least two reasons why it does. In the first place, this war is not wrong just because it's illegal. On the contrary, like murder itself, it's illegal because it's wrong. It's a deliberate taking of human life, not because this is absolutely necessary to save life, but rather to make some political point. These people's lives, the Afghan villagers and the Taliban recruits alike, are worth every bit as much as the people who died in New York and Washington on September 11th. This war is the moral as well as the legal equivalent of the attacks on September 11th. But there is one big difference, and that's a difference in degree. Because the harm done on September 11th in New York and Washington was only a tiny fraction of the harm the U.S. has been doing all around the world. Far from being a war against terrorism, this is a war conducted by the world's foremost terrorist state. As a phone caller at a phone-in show told me, the United States practices economic terrorism against the world, against the poor of the world, every day. And it's a lot more lethal than a suicide bomber. And what else do you call the war against Iraq? 10 years of bombings. Thanks. 2 minutes is all I'll need. 10 years of bombings and sanctions and hundreds of thousands dead. What the hell difference does it make that Saddam, that some of it is caused by Saddam building presidential palaces? These children would not be dead if it were not for the sanctions. The U.S. is as guilty as if it had dropped one of its nuclear bombs because these children are every bit as dead. And after they finish with Afghanistan, they're going to try and finish the job in Iraq. And they're going to call it self-defense against Saddam's weapons of mass destruction. And what's the death of hundreds of thousands of people if not mass destruction? And what's going on in Afghanistan if not mass destruction? And what are B-52s and F-14s and cluster bombs and Apache helicopters and cruise missiles if not weapons of mass destruction? And who has the world's biggest stash of nuclear weapons if not the U.S.? And they claim they're finding chemical weapons plants in Afghanistan. What do you think you'd find in the laboratories of the U.S. Army? Saddam has defied U.N. weapons inspectors. And who was it that used the U.N. weapons inspection system to spy on Iraqi defenses so they could bomb them? Ask Richard Butler or ask Scott Ritter. Ask the New York Times. George Bush is lucky that the American people get their information from the zombies on CNN. Anyway, now think of Israel. It's no surprise Israel will be using the same Alice in Wonderland pot calling the kettle black rhetoric as the Americans. Yoel Marcus called it in Haaretz on Friday a cheap local imitation of a coinage by U.S. President George W. Bush. Must be pretty cheap coinage. Anyway, because the violence you see in Israel is the direct effect of an illegal and brutal military occupation that has lasted 34 years. Israel calls the Palestinians terrorists, and the Palestinian Authority a harbor of terrorists. But who has killed more civilians, Israel or the Palestinians? Just stick to the 1,000 dead in the past year. If you go back further, the odds get worse. In fact, it's running about 3 or 4 to 1 for Israel. 2 weeks ago, the Israeli army booby-trapped a bomb and killed 5 Palestinian children. If a terrorist is somebody who kills civilians, then in my books, the bigger terrorist is the one who kills more civilians. If Canada's going to ban fundraising for Hamas, they should ban the United Jewish Appeal. If they're going to deport all the terrorists, we should close the Israeli embassy. And the American one, too, because Israel would be nothing without the U.S. If the U.S. gave the Palestinians tanks and jets, you can bet they wouldn't be blowing themselves up in pizzerias, nightclubs, on buses, and in pedestrian malls. I say this as a Jew who loves Israel and cannot believe how the Israelis have turned it into a nightmare for Jews and Palestinians alike. There's another reason the illegality of this war matters. It's because of its betrayal of the pacifist commitment of the Charter of the United Nations with its carefully designed structure of collective responsibility for the peaceful resolution of disputes wherever humanly possible and the use of war only as a last resort and truly in the collective interest. When governments start to ignore the rules against violence, we're in deep trouble because that's what happened in the 20s and the 30s. They were followed by the 40s, and after 50 million people had died, we sat down and wrote the Charter of the United Nations to try to put an end to war. The attack on Afghanistan is not about self-defense against terrorism. It's about a lot of things, but it's not about that. The self-defense justification becomes so absurd that they've started to describe this as a humanitarian intervention. Marcus G., in the Globe and Mail called it a golden opportunity to end Afghanistan's agony. When the Taliban finally fall, billions of dollars in reconstruction aid will flow in. A new government, perhaps backed by the UN, will take power. Far from being a tragedy for the Afghans, this war could be the best thing that has happened to them in two decades. Then we get the smirking generals. They talk about liberating Afghanistan. Take about a minute. Really, this is, you know, you got a minute, okay? Do we have a minute? We get the CNN footage of happy Afghan males, beardless in Kabul, watching Western soft porn. The women are in burqa still, though. Maybe they haven't heard that the Taliban have been overthrown, or maybe they've listened to the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, who say that there's absolutely no difference between the Northern Alliance and the Taliban when it comes to hatred of women. Anyway, the American media is lying through its teeth. This is a media that can make George Bush look like a president. I am wrapping up. I'm wrapping up. Can I have one more minute? Thank you. Okay. Leo, this is not stand-up comedy, okay? Give me a minute to finish, okay? Okay. The American media aren't showing the sickening death and destruction that everyone knows is occurring, and other more responsible media, like our own, are reporting. The farce in Bonn, with all the parties in such quick agreement, that was pure Hollywood PR. Just like the two women ministers, try to find women ministers in Saudi Arabia. Just like the token rations dropped with cluster bombs while aid to a starving people was cut off. And $10 billion won't even pay for the damage done by American bombs in the last 2 months. But let's see if any of it makes it past the warlords who've already started killing each other over the Taliban spoils. In fact, the U.S. always talks big about the rosy future of the countries it bombs into submission, but it rarely delivers on its promises. There are no rosy futures for countries as desperately poor as Afghanistan. But the biggest U.S. media lie, now I am finishing, is that this has been a blow to terrorism. All that has really happened is that the world's leading terrorist state receives a big boost for its terrorist and terrorist-promoting ways. It's proved to itself that it can get away with murder, that the famous free media of the U.S. is just its willing tool, that its constitution is just paper, that so is the U.N. Charter, and it doesn't have to worry about the presumed sensitivities of its Arab allies. And that means that its proxies have become bolder, too. Israel hasn't felt this free to attack the Palestinians in years. And this just guarantees there'll be more Talibans, more Al-Qaedas, more towers, more Afghanistans, maybe in different places with different names. It's because the Americans behave this way, the way they have for the past 2 months, that incidents like September 11th occur. It's because the Israelis act the way they do in the West Bank and Gaza that Ben Yehuda Street is such a dangerous place on Saturday night. Look at it this way. The Americans are one of the few countries to think the death penalty is an appropriate response to murder. They have one of the highest murder rates in the world, with homegrown terrorists sending anthrax to the males, high school students massacring their classmates. You know the American murder rate? The Americans murder each other at a rate of one September 11th every 3 months. Al-Qaeda was supposed to have been exporting terrorism to the world. Well, the U.S. appears to have gone to the export business itself. It's exporting Texas's winning formula for happiness. Fabulous wealth for the few amidst squalor and poverty for others, with a death penalty as the result. Thank you.